From the Sky News Centre at 5, Andy Murray's Wimbledon semi-final against Rafael Nadal is underway. The British number one is bidding to reach the final for the first time. We can go to our reporter Simon Owen now, who's live from Centre Court.
And if Murray can win this afternoon and reach the final, it'd be a first for a British man since 1938. He's also playing one of the greatest players who ever lived. No pressure then. It's going with serve in the first set. Two games all. Now 3-2 to Murray. And whoever wins this one will play Novak Djokovic in the final on Sunday. He beat Joe Wilfried Tsonga in 4.
Thank you, Simon. The Duke and Duchess of Cambridge have been handing out national flags to new citizens of Canada at a ceremony in Ottawa. They're taking part in a 12-day visit to Canada and the US. Thousands of Canadians have lined the streets to catch a glimpse of the royal couple. Sarah Goodall, a former aide to Prince Charles, says William is taking a different approach to the trip compared to his father.
I think this 8-day visit will be a real success and, in fact, very different to that one 28 years ago that Diana and Charles made. And I think that we're seeing a whole new angle here to the royal visit.
Dominique Strauss-Kahn has been released without bail during a court appearance in New York. A hotel maid has accused the former IMF chief of sexual assault. There have been reports that investigators are now questioning her credibility as a witness. A woman who strangled her severely autistic son has walked free from court. Yvonne Freeney was suffering from mental health problems when she killed 11-year-old Glenn in a hotel room near Cardiff last year. More than 100 jobs could go at Birmingham Prison as it moves from the public to private sector. Security firm G4S says 123 full-time positions are at risk, mostly in management, operational support, facilities and admin. And Monaco's Prince Albert II has married former Olympic swimmer Charlene Whitstock in a civil ceremony. Charlene now becomes Princess of Monaco, succeeding Grace Kelly. That's the latest. I'm Christian Yeo.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Hello, Bristol. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time. Tony Gosling, and helping us review the news this week is former Bristol MP and Labour councillor for Avonmouth, Doug Naismith. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, Monday is the 4th of July. That's US Independence Day. But at some American bases in the UK, local people will be celebrating independence from America. Just like the Afghans and Iraqis, the US president gets on their nerves and they're fed up with fenced-off sections of Britain being treated as America's unsinkable aircraft carrier. And what do former soldiers make of the role of the British Army today? We hear from two veterans who've been to hell and back and have their doubts on the return about the way Britain projects power in the 21st century. Plus we hear from a Swiss author whose book, NATO's Secret Armies, documents at last NATO's top secret programme of blowing up police and innocent civilians in different parts of Europe and blaming it on the Russians back in the Cold War. Plus, the concluding extract from Keith Allen's banned film, Unlawful Killing, about the assassination of Princess Diana, according to Keith, which is being watched everywhere in the world except in Britain. That's in the second hour after 6. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Anyway, joining us, that's weather forecast, sorry about that. Tonight, the lows of 10 degrees Celsius and some light rain. This weekend, highs of 23 Celsius, sunshine and showers this weekend, although wetter on Sunday. The opposite of last weekend. So, yes, warm and dry on Saturday, a bit wetter on Sunday. Now, highs next week of 23 Celsius, again, nice and hot and warm, and plenty of sun, although some showers too. Next weekend, the 9th and 10th of July, that's highs of 20 Celsius, and the rain will be not so much, but mostly sunny and fairly dry. That's next weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guest now, and joining us is former Bristol MP and Labour councillor for Avonmouth, Doug Naismith. Hi, Doug. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hello, Tony. It's good to be back after a year or two. Yeah.
Okay. Now, first of all, how had you managed to make the transition from MP to councillor? Isn't that sort of backsliding somewhat?
I don't think it's backsliding. I mean, I've reached the grand age of 70, so it's time for me to sort of take life a little bit easier. But actually, it surprised me a bit that just how much I've got to do now that I'm a member of Bristol City Council and also of the Avon and Somerset Police Authority. So I'm almost as busy as I was, but I don't have to go up and down to Westminster every week. So that's a plus.
Now, I'm glad you mentioned the police authority, because we had a little clip of you on last week talking about that. They're talking actually about abolishing you. So can you tell us, what is the police authority and who makes it up?
Basically, there are 9 local councillors for coming from Avon and Somerset, which is quite a wide area, quite a different area, different kinds of places, different kinds of towns make it up. And there are 8 independent members who are appointed to the police authority. They usually are people who've got experience in the probation service or the magistrate service or social work or the National Health Service, but there are some business people as well. So it's a real interesting mixture. It is political in that the councillors are political. Of course, the independent members aren't. But I find it an interesting politics, because it's not the yaboo politics of either Westminster or Bristol City Council, if I can be so bold. And we do our best to work for the people in Avon and Somerset, and their job is to work with the police, the constabulary as we call them, try to make sure that the budget that they set is good and it's fair enough and it reflects the priorities of the police authority, and that the police authority reflects the views of the people, the local people who live in the area. And it's interesting being the only Labour councillor on the whole shebang.
So, of course, you've got councillors from places like North Somerset and similar.
Taunton and Somerset County. And
which Bath. Are mostly Conservative.
Or Lib Dem. There are some
or Lib Dem.
A few of them have changed after the recent election.
But now, it's nice to hear there are elected councillors on that committee, but what about the other members, the lay members, and what do you say, I think magistrates, some of them, or not?
Ex-magistrates.
Oh, former magistrates. Former who decides who those people are? Who's allowed to go
apply.
On?
People apply for the positions. They're advertised, and they're interviewed by the existing members of the police authority. They're not all appointed as a block of 8. Their terms of office come to an end at different times, and they're interviewed and by the police authority, as I say, and appointed that way.
So the talk is that you're being abolished by May next year. That's the talk. And how definite is that?
Well, the bill, not unlike a few other bills where the coalition government has run into a bit of flack in Parliament, and it has been destroyed by an amendment by peers in the House of Lords. But the government says that it's going to reverse that in the House of Commons, and although it may be delayed, it should come into effect next May, and the people of Avon and Somerset should be electing a police commissioner instead of having a police authority like we are. I think it's a retrograde step, because it will introduce the kind of thing that I've been suggesting. I think is a benefit of the police authority. It will be very political, I'm sure, in a place like, well, Bristol and the old Avon and Somerset County, the bits that aren't in North Somerset. They will, it will be political. It's bound to be political. And the government think that people aren't able to get a traction on what the police authority, and through them the police themselves, do, and that it will be easier with one police commissioner. The idea comes from America, where they've got elected mayors and elected police commissioners and elected dog catchers and all sorts of things directly elected. And as a Democrat, I'm not against elections, but sometimes you can put people into a position where one individual has far too much authority and far too much power. And I think the other thing that police authorities and the commissioner, one does now and will be able to do in the future, is choose the chief of police. And traditionally, chiefs of police in this country have tended to be non-political and to be not reflect any particular views. And they would probably, if you've got a political individual appointing a police commissioner, then they're going to appoint people who have the same sort of ideas as them.
Now, there's two arguments, really, I think, here. One is that, to have one person makes it a lot easier to make quick, decisive action, this kind of thing. But the trouble is, of course, one person is more easily corruptible than a whole committee.
Absolutely.
So overall, you're against it. But aren't you just against it because you're on the police authority as it is?
I mean, the reason I'm on the police authority is because Bristol City Council appoints two representatives. And while I was a Member of Parliament, I worked fairly closely with the now Chief Constable Colin Port and one or two others before that. And I got interested in the sorts of things that the police authority does. So when I got elected to the council last year, I put in for the nomination from Bristol City Council and got it. And I've enjoyed a year on it, and I can see the benefits of it. But I'm not a dyed-in-the-wool police authority person who thinks, oh, it's the only way to do it. I just think giving that much power to one individual is open to corruption, but it also... people will know who it is, and that person will have to make popular decisions and things in order to be re-elected. And I think that opens up the possibility of not necessarily the best. And the final thing is, I know you want to get in, the final thing is, Avon and Somerset is a very diverse area. Bristol City, which is one of the biggest cities in England, and Bath, which is not a big city but is a city. Then you've got all the rural areas of Somerset, you've got South Gloucestershire, which is, and Bath and North East Somerset. And so it's a very unusual area. Taunton, Weston-super-Mare, Portishead, all will have different things that they want the police to do that are catered for under the present system, but probably won't be in the same sort of way with a commissioner.
The constabulary boundaries used to reflect that, didn't they? Because it used to be a completely separate Bristol constabulary and the more rural Somerset. Anyway...
Actually, just going back a little bit, you're talking about corruption. If you hear some of the stories about the old Bristol police force, it wasn't called the police force then, it was called something else, but there was a huge amount of corruption went on then.
On that note, we'll introduce Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Martin, the Greek government have agreed to another set of privatisations this week, another bailout. Do they have a choice?
Well, they're being forced into a corner, aren't they? I think they're rather foolish to accept this bailout. I can't see that the bond market are going to be happy with it anyway. They can see that the people can't... I mean, people, as Keynes said in the 30s, debts that can't be paid won't be paid. And that's not a political point, it's a logical point.
Well, they just borrowed a bit more money, because otherwise they won't be able to pay any of their staff.
What they've done is they've taken bailout money and then they've handed it straight back to the German and French banks and to the British banks to cover the interest on the debt that they owe. So none of this money is actually going to go to Greece. And, of course, what the Germans moaning about saying we're going to bail the Greeks out, what they're doing is they're bailing out their own banks. Now, the Greeks should actually just basically probably leave the euro and devalue their currency, but that will crash the banking system.
Yes, but they haven't done that. They've decided this week definitely not to do that. Don't you think there's animosity now building up between the Greeks and the Germans?
It's quite clear that the Greek population do not want to swallow this pill, and they're right, because there's no point. Even when you swallowed it, all that happens is you die. What they need to do is have restructure everything. But, of course, we're way, way too far down the line now. I took a £5 bet with a guy from Lloyd's last Thursday, and I said, I bet you the banks will go down before Christmas. And he said, OK, I'll take that £5 bet. And I said, I don't want to succeed in my bet, but that's the way it's looking to me. It's very scary.
The other thing, of course, is this week, Christine Lagarde has been appointed as the head of the IMF. And just a couple of days later, we hear Dominique Strauss-Kahn is likely to be found innocent, possibly. Is that coincidence? I mean,
I wouldn't like to comment on the case against Dominique
Strauss-Kahn. I mean, if Dominique Strauss-Kahn is found innocent, surely the whole thing of him being bounced out...
Christine Lagarde is definitely a Wall Street poodle, absolutely. There was talk of having somebody from not a European, perhaps somebody from China or India or something like that to head up the IMF. She is very much a Wall Street person, and therefore no use at all, really.
It's interesting with Christine Lagarde that last night Michael Pertullo was saying she's absolutely awful and was the worst choice possible.
Yeah.
So
that sums it up.
I suppose what I'm saying here is it becoming a little bit more obvious that maybe what happened to Dominic Strauss-Kahn was some kind of sting operation?
Well, there's lots of speculation about that, as you well know. I mean, he was clearly much more. He was slight. I mean, he was going to be the socialist presidential candidate in France, so he was obviously somewhat to the left of Christine Lagarde. And of course, he was actually talking in terms of we'll have to. You know, he was actually more flexible than the usual run-of-the-mill IMF director.
Martin, what was he actually planning to do? Because I remember reading that this would affect the American banks massively if his plan had gone through, but suddenly he was in court and he couldn't carry out.
Yeah, but basically, I mean, I don't think he was that good, but he was talking about flexibility rather than just, you know, nailing our ears to the floor, which is what the rest of them want to do.
Well, one of the things, I mean, if you believe with the Daily Mail, one of the things I was reading in the Daily Mail was that he was planning to have to consolidate a lot of this debt between these different countries like Ireland, Greece, etc., and to have the finance ministers of Ireland, Greece, Portugal, etc., all on one side of the table, and the IMF on the other side of the table, actually negotiating together.
Well, the real problem is the bondholders. They're insisting that the private people, private individuals who, and private banks which hold bonds, they've all got to be paid in full. Now, this is just nonsense, really. I mean, Angela Merkel was talking about them having a haircut. You know, they'll have to take some losses, but at the moment, They're not prepared to take any losses at all. So all the losses are being taken by the society, by the people, and the banks are not prepared to take any losses at all. And of course, they can't afford to take any losses at all because they're insolvent. The banking system is insolvent, despite the fact that they're putting paper profits. They're claiming to make loads of profits, which means that they can pay themselves bonuses and they pay the shareholders off. But the banks are bust. It's a whole joke. It's a joke, actually.
And can I ask Martin? Yeah, why is it? Why don't they just default? Why doesn't
They will in the end anyway.
Why don't they just do it? Because I heard somebody saying on the radio, I forget it was, but an economist like you was saying that in America, he's an American economist, in America there are states which get into financial trouble and they have gone bankrupt in the past. And it doesn't bring down the dollar. I mean, these are very small countries.
The problem is that it's
smaller than some American states.
Yeah, the problem is that the debt overhang is now so enormous that any one country like Greece defaulting could bring down the whole lot. I mean, when Argentina defaulted in 2000, that nearly brought down the whole lot. When Mexico, the tequila crisis in the 90s, just one country defaulting is enough to bring the whole thing down because it's a pack of cards, it's a house of cards, you know.
But isn't it also fair to say there's not really the political will in Greece to actually go down that road? It's a road they don't feel
well, it's a stupid road anyway, because what's happened over the last 2 years of austerity is their debts have got bigger. That's what happens. You can't cut your way out of a hole like that. You're just digging yourself deeper in. And of course the Conservative Liberal coalition is doing exactly the same thing here. They're going to lose Britain's credit rating. By the end of the year, Britain will lose its credit rating because of their cuts policy, and at that point there will be an ERM moment when suddenly the economic policy of the government will be shown to be complete shambles, which it is. It's a total shambles.
Okay, well, back to home, and on the Evening Post today, they're talking about an integrated transport authority. We've talked about this on this programme quite a lot in the past. Various attempts have been made to have some kind of transport authority in Bristol to link up railways, buses, taxis, other sorts of systems, but mainly the sort of things we think of as public transport, like the buses and the trains. Doug, what are your thoughts about this?
Well, I'm really very pleased that this has happened. It's not quite clear what form this integrated transport authority will take, but certainly when I was in Parliament I campaigned strongly to try and get an integrated transport authority for this area. But the thing that held it up was that there are four local authorities involved and they all have to agree to make an application, and it always proved impossible to get them all to agree up until now. But it does seem as if some agreement has been reached, and what that will do will enable, if it goes through as a proper integrated transport authority, like it happens in, you know, Manchester and all its surrounding local authorities, Newcastle and Gateshead and all the
most cities on the continent too. Yeah,
and most cities, like our twin town Hanover, has got a wonderful transport system. Anyway, if this happens, it means they'll be able to set up a little, not really a company, but something like a company that'll see the whole thing as an integrated whole, railways and possibly trams and buses and everything, and do it as a proper integrated job, but, and be able to ask for government money.
But for people stuck in jams out there, what they want to know is, am I going to be able to leave my car at home and rely on a system of getting in and out of the city that's going to be reasonably cheap and reliable? This is reliability, because this is why people use their cars, is because sometimes they'll go and wait for a bus, the bus that doesn't turn up.
Well, this is an immensely complicated subject, and we could spend an hour and a half talking about it. The first thing you've got to recognise is that Bristol is a very difficult place to organise a transport system in. Many cities, like Edinburgh, where I grew up, has got a big long street, never mind its tram problems now, but it's a great big long street, and they all shoot out all over the place, and you get into the centre and then you're there. Bristol has this historic harbour, the floating harbour, and all the ramifications of that, which makes it incredibly difficult to have a really good transport system going into the centre and out to all the places. Having said that, this ought to make things a lot better, and I don't know, to get the reliability will mean spending a lot of money. And I've been involved with things like this in the city for a very long time. I remember Richard Cottrell, who some people, maybe you don't remember, but some people in the city will, he was the Euro Conservative Euro MP who was going to build us a metro system based on the increase in value of the sites where the stations would be. That's nearly 30 years ago now, and it never came to fruition.
Yes, and the tram that hasn't. Anyway, what do you make of this, Martin?
Well, obviously, it's a positive development. I wonder whether, when push comes to shove, the money to develop this will be there. Because, of course, we're in a crisis situation where we could end up with a situation where no money is made available. Local authorities may go bust. I mean, in the US, lots of local authorities are going bust. Let's hope it doesn't work out that way for Bristol.
Well, one of the things that it says on the map here, in the Evening Post, is that more than a dozen disused stations could be brought back into use, creating a suburban rail network that fully connects Bristol, North Somerset, South Gloucestershire and Bath. I mean, this is actually something like, is that nearly 10 new stations around?
Well, there are three different things going on here. One is the agreement to seek an integrated transport site. That's one thing. Second thing is that the local area, First Great Western and other rail companies, are going to look at bringing back into use suburban railway lines around Bristol. Now, that would probably form a plan that could be integrated into the ITA, but they're not directly linked. And the third thing is, I understand there's been some agreement to seek funding for the reopening of the Portishead rail line, which would be a wonderful thing to do.
Can I just say, of course, if we were to reflate the economy, this is exactly the sort of stuff we should do.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we should be saying, this is what we need to do to get people back to work, and we're going to do it, and we will find the money. Because that's the attitude. That's got to be the attitude. We can't just wait for the market to sort this out. No. It never will. Until we've got to get our act together, decide what we want to do, and do it.
Well, the Evening Post finishes its article with saying, campaigners want it, MPs want it, councillors want it, businesses want it, transport operators want it, and most important, residents want it. So let's get moving. Well, let's just hope that this time...
It's only taken 30 years.
It's not going to be another pie-in-the-sky dream.
Well, with the Evening Post behind it, well, you never know.
We will get an integrated transport authority, and let's hope so, anyhow. Well, after last week's party leaders' approval rating poll, well, that was a Guardian poll, putting Ed Miliband at minus 21, even lower than Nick Clegg at minus 20, Ed bravely stepped up to the dispatch box at Wednesday's Prime Minister's Question Time, and he stumbled over his words again. Not only that, he forgot to mention either of the two stories of the week, which the Prime Minister, David Cameron, would have been on very shaky ground. That is, Christopher Shale, Cameron's constituency chairman, had said the week before about the Tory party, "We come across as graceless, voracious, crass, always on the take. People think we'll beg and steal from them, and they're right." But Ed Miliband didn't want to mention that. So what exactly did he say?
Mr. Ed Miliband.
Mr. Speaker, the whole country will have heard that he has admitted they're spending £852 million on making people redundant, and he can't even promise they won't be rehired through their old jobs. And isn't the truth, Mr. Speaker? He promised no top-down reorganisation. He's doing it. He promised the bonfire of the quangos. He's creating more. He promised a better deal for patients, and things are getting worse. What people are asking up and down this country is, what is he doing to our NHS? Yes.
What the whole country will have noticed is, at a time when people are worried about strikes, he can't ask about strikes because he's in the pocket of the unions. What the whole country will have noticed is, at a time when Greece is facing huge problems over its deficit, he can't talk about Greece because his plan is to make Britain like Greece. What the whole country will have noticed is at a time when the economy is the key issue, he can't talk about the economy because of his ludicrous plan for tax cuts. That's what we see week after week. He has to talk about the micro because he can't talk about the macro.
We're very grateful. Gito Beb.
Yes, that was David Cameron's exchange with Ed Miliband, the Labour leader at Prime Minister's Questions. Doug, as an ex-MP who's been in the chamber there, why is Ed talking about the NHS, which isn't a big item in the news over the last 10 days or so, when he's got all these other things like the pension strike? Now, I'm not totally complaining about Ed, because David Cameron didn't even answer the question that he asked, did he? But don't you think there's a little bit of a problem in that he seems to be sort of wide of the mark slightly?
Look, there's a lot can be said about this. First of all, I mean, David Cameron promised he wouldn't do the sort of thing he's been doing ever since he was in before. He wanted to make question time civilised. People asked serious questions, came back with serious answers. But it's not been like that. He's just like everybody else is at Prime Minister's Questions. Except he's very good at the sort of one-liners and the broad stuff. But what Ed has been doing for the last two or three weeks, and relatively successfully, he's been questioning Cameron on the detail of policies and not broad sweep. And Cameron's not very good on the detail. The past 3 weeks, including this week, Cameron was looking at his notes, flicking through them, trying to find the answer to the sort of things that Ed was asking him. And I think Ed, who's not about a year into the job, is doing pretty well. Leaders take a long time to establish themselves. Even Tony Blair, who was one of the most successful leaders ever, wasn't immediately successful. And Ed's doing not too badly. There are one or two other things about this, of course. I don't agree with you that the National Health Service is a small story. For me, it's probably the biggest story of the last few weeks and month, even alongside all the economic difficulties, because despite what has happened with having the pause and bringing in some changes to the bill, some of the changes that have been brought in make the bill worse, and some of them are just varnish on the surface. They don't change anything.
But, Doug, we've had hundreds of thousands.
Really important.
We've had hundreds of thousands of people on the street striking this week, and yet that wasn't even mentioned by Ed.
Well, lots of people in the Labour Party are supportive of what's happening with the negotiations about pensions for public servants, including me. But these kinds of strikes are very difficult for Labour leaders, partly because strikes, for which are perfectly justifiable and people should have the right to strike, were developed 100, maybe more than 100 years ago, so that you could target an employer and you were prepared to lose money as a striker, but your employer lost profits because whether it was digging coal out or whether it was manufacturing or whatever it was, the person who was targeted was the one who suffered. Now, public service strikes are not like that. So the politicians have to at least be aware of the possibility that if the public is against them, then they're going to help the strikers to lose the cause. Now, even Neil Kinnock had a terrible time, similar terrible time, over the miners' strike. Because although I'm sure that Neil was sympathetic and having been brought up in Wales and having, you know, sort of all the history of the Welsh mining industry, but he just couldn't come out and say that Labour fully supported the strike, because given that Arthur Scargill at the time was refusing to have a ballot, the whole thing's always much more complicated. And it's not just a question of, yay, we support the strike. There are usually other issues, and there are other issues in this one as well. I really enjoyed this week hearing Francis Maude on the Breakfast, not the Breakfast Show, the Today programme, being found out saying that pensions were getting too expensive and actually quoting Hutton's report wrongly, because unaffordable doesn't appear in Hutton's report at all, and Maude had to admit that he was wrong. So there was a government minister telling lies about the strike.
But if he's pulling his punches, Martin, is Ed going to actually win at the dispatch box?
Well, I mean, I dislike Prime Minister's Question Time anyway. It's a really... I mean, foreigners come and watch that little charade, and they go, so that's it, is it? That's your politics? I mean, when I was in Poland, I was in the Polish Parliament, the same. and it's very boring. It's like watching paint dry, because people just come up to the rostrum, read through their stuff to get it on the record. Everybody sits around in their offices. It's a business-like atmosphere.
But at least
completely
the public...
different from what we get in Britain.
Think you can ignore the fact that it's the only democracy in the world where backbenchers can ask the Prime Minister of the day.
Yeah, but because they've got no real power. What backbenchers do in Poland is they're stitching things up.
I've seen Prime Ministers embarrassed and upset by being asked awkward questions.
The other thing is, I think the public, at least they get to see the Prime Minister talking about current affairs, stuff that's going on that week, hopefully, and they can make their own personal assessment of whether they think he's up for the job.
Yeah, that's true.
Why do you think he didn't mention the strike, for example?
Well, I mean, there's some things that Doug suggested. I mean, I was talking to some teachers yesterday, and they were a bit disappointed that he hadn't come out and supported them. I said, well, they can't, really. I mean, my attitude is... Labour leaders do what Labour leaders do, and we do what we do. The unions are not beholden to the Labour Party, and the Labour Party isn't beholden to the unions. And they've just got, they're separate things, and they're going to do separate things in a different way. Trade unions have got their own role, and I totally agree that you can't, the public sector strikes, you've got to keep public support with you. But ultimately, my dad was a teacher trade unionist, and he said, what you've got to do is you don't withdraw goodwill. Because that's what happened in the 80s. Teachers withdraw goodwill. They stopped doing the sports teams. They stopped doing things. Everybody was clock watching, and that was wrong. They should have had goodwill all the way. Do all the sports teams. All that. So when you're on strike, you're on strike. And of course, teachers' strikes bite much quicker than miners' strikes. They bite the next day, and the day after, and the day after. And the answer to that is you get on the phone to the Prime Minister and you say that you get this sorted out. But of course, teachers tend to be middle class. They don't have the kind of consciousness. There's so many different teachers' trade unions. They don't have the consciousness of miners, for example.
But listen, isn't it, do you think, maybe just sour grapes from the leadership of the Labour Party that these unions aren't any more affiliated to Labour and don't pay Labour any money?
I don't think the National Union of Teachers was ever affiliated to the Labour Party.
No. So that may have something to do with it. Anyway,
I don't think the civil servants were either, because they wouldn't have been allowed to be.
There's talk of a general strike in the autumn. And I think the best way to deal with that is not to have official strikes necessarily. The unions may just have to walk on by because they can be sequestrated, but you don't have to be in a union to go on strike. They go on strike in France all the time, but they're not union members. You just walk out.
Okay, on to another story. And one of the chief representatives in Jerusalem of the Islamic People, Sheikh Raed Salah, was arrested in his hotel room at 11 on Tuesday this week, having arrived in Britain on Saturday and addressed several meetings. Paul Brennan from Al Jazeera reports.
Also asking officials here when and why that travel ban was imposed, when even Israel recognises Sheikh Salah's organisation as legitimate. The criteria for exclusion is broad and can include anyone whose presence is judged not conducive to the public good. There's been only a brief explanatory statement from the Interior Minister saying, "We do not normally comment on individual cases, but in this case I think it is important to do so. I can confirm he was excluded and that he managed to enter the UK. He has now been detained and the UK Border Agency is now making arrangements to remove him." Salah has had multiple run-ins with the Israeli authorities in the past. He spent 2 years behind bars in 2003, accused of raising millions of pounds for Hamas. But the motives for the British authorities detaining him now are far from clear. Paul Brennan, Al Jazeera, London.
Well, Salah has frequently provoked the Israeli authorities over the years. He's part of the Islamic movement in Israel, an organisation that isn't banned, but's closely monitored by Israeli officials. He was barred from travelling to the UK, though the UK Home Office has not confirmed when or why the travel ban was put in place. Salah has been detained several times in Israel, most recently at the Jordan-Israeli border, after he'd allegedly hit an interrogator. And in 2010, he spent 5 months in jail for spitting at an Israeli police officer. He was also held after taking part in a Gaza-bound aid flotilla that Israeli naval commandos stormed in May of last year.
That was a report on Al Jazeera about the arrest of Sheikh Raed Salah. Martin, you first on this one. Now, the Daily Mail and other papers have rather annoyed me by painting out some sort of picture here of him trying to sneak into Britain, whereas actually he had permission to come here, and it seems like it was only pressure several days after he arrived that led to his arrest. So what's going on?
Well, I think it's disgraceful, frankly. I mean, the guy is a legitimate politician, represents a lot of people in Palestine, in Israel. Well, he's, why is he being bullied around? It's just outrageous, frankly.
I don't know a lot about this, but it does seem to me absolutely ridiculous that if he was banned, he was allowed to walk in. And it is ridiculous that the Home Secretary can't say, given that she is responsible for signing some sort of thing saying he would be banned, can't say that she didn't, she says that she didn't know why he had been banned and for how long and when. Just the whole thing seems like a terrible muddle, and it should never have happened.
Well, I've picked up a press release from something called Middle East Monitor, which says that immediately after they, it was announced that it was hosting, Middle East Monitor was hosting Sheikh Raed Salah, a public lecturer at Queen Mary University, a well-known pro-Israeli website circulated a catalogue of lies and fabrications about Sheikh Raed Salah, which he's refuted for years. And on Thursday, 16th of June, he issued an unequivocal statement refuting the claims, ordered lawyers in London to challenge these fabrications in the British High Court. On the 24th of June, lawyers acting on Sheikh Raed's behalf served no notice on Andrew Gilligan of the Daily Telegraph and Robin Rosen of the Jewish Chronicle. These procedures began before Sheikh Raed entered the country and were publicly announced. I think actually this can be a sort of Islamophobia style press story, can't it, Doug? When newspapers like the Daily Mail actually start talking about him trying to sneak past, you know, smuggle himself in, where actually he's been completely open about coming into Britain.
I mean, that was said on major media like the BBC, that he was open. He hadn't been stopped at the authorities. The other thing is interesting that Andrew Gilligan's involved. That's a name from the past, isn't it?
Yes. Well, I think what's odd here is that Yvette Cooper is saying that he should be banned, and of course he was going to meet three Labour MPs, Jeremy Corbyn, Richard Burden and Yasmin Qureshi. I mean, this is ridiculous. I mean, Hamas and all of these political movements inside Israel and Palestine, they are absolutely legitimate political interlocutors. And this idea that we're not to speak to these people because the Israelis don't like it, well, frankly, that's just, you know, the Israelis can
It's not just that the Israelis don't like it. They see Hamas as a terrorist organisation.
Well, I see the Israeli state as a terrorist organisation. Perhaps we should bomb them like we did the Serbs.
Well, it seems that Theresa May, Home Secretary, agrees with them and not with you.
Well, it's so, because Israel has a grip on British foreign policy, don't they?
How?
Because I don't know how. It's because they control both major political parties. The Israeli state is extremely busy around the world making sure they get what they want. I think it's outrageous that they can stop people coming to this country to talk to us. Who the hell do they think they are?
I mean, isn't it quite legitimate for the Israeli government to lobby in Britain, lobby political parties in Britain?
Yes, and it's legitimate for him to come and lobby as well. And why isn't he being allowed to do it? And I'm rather disappointed that Yvette Cooper is going along with this. It's no good.
I think I'm going to give the last word to you on this one, Doug. Which side of this do you come down?
Well, I mean, I tend to agree with a lot of what's just been said, but we don't really know the facts of this. We don't know why he was banned, really. And we've got to wait till that comes out. But Hamas is not a nice organisation.
They're the elected government of Palestine,
that's right,
period.
That's right. That doesn't make it. So was some other left-wing organisations in
they've supplanted the PLO because they're more honest.
Yeah, that's
and that's true. And they are the representatives of the Palestinian people. That's all there is to it.
On to our next story, and up to Scotland now. The constituency of Inverclyde is a bit of a forgotten corner of Scotland, a former shipbuilding heartland, but not forgotten this week, as there was a by-election after the death of the sitting MP. The result was announced today. It's a much reduced majority for Labour, indicating dissatisfaction with the Labour Party in what's been a safe seat for 70 years, but which isn't anymore. The BBC's Chris Mason was there early in the week and asked local residents Anne and Sandra what living in Inverclyde was like in this post-industrial town.
There's nothing for the children now. Nothing at all. They're leaving school and there's nothing. They're going out and nothing. There's no jobs. There's nothing for youngsters at all.
Basically, Inverclyde is just drink drugs nowadays. And the kids, Sandra's right, they're coming out of school. A lot of them's going to college, universities, you name it. They're getting their hires, everything that they want. And at the end of the day, there's not a job for them. They can't even get into a job. Like Tesco's, packing shelves, nothing, there's not a thing. And I think that's why half of the kids turn to drink and drugs, because as far as they're concerned, life is just finished for them. That's all they've got left. It's the only pleasure they seem to have in Inverclyde now. Their life is over at 16. Once they leave school, there is nothing for the young ones, not a thing.
I was on the bus this morning and there was a couple of druggies on the bus.
And there's this guy sitting up the back, and two girls come on at Belleville Street and right up and punched the hell right out of him on the bus.
And this is at what, 9 o'clock in the morning?
The last was at 9:15 in the morning, and this last was punching hell at this guy on the bus. And that's through drugs. It's terrible that you can't go on a bus and sit to go into the town quietly without all that happening. And it's happening quite a lot.
The government has got to come out with stricter sentences. Throw them on an island, as far as I'm concerned. Put them on an island, all the truckies. Let them do what they want to each other. But let decent people live. And the decent people in Inverclyde have not got a life. Because the druggies have took over. And the government has got to. They've got to change the law. When, I don't know. But until they do that, this place is going downhill fast. It's like a sinking ship.
It's an interesting analogy you used at the end there. That was a couple of people from Inverclyde. Now, Doug Naismith, your Labour councillor here in Bristol, what can be done in these post-industrial cities? And let's face it, Bristol is
possibly a post-industrial city. I was about to say that Inverclyde is not... That was not an absolutely accurate representation of Inverclyde. In fact, there are some very nice places round about Inverclyde. And I was going to add, and there are one or two places in Bristol I could take you to where you would hear exactly the same sort of thing. And almost everywhere in Bristol, if you go, you'll also hear something else, which isn't true. There's nothing for the young people to do, which actually isn't true either, but people tend to say that. Nonetheless, Inverclyde's on the outskirts of Glasgow, just over the border, and Glasgow has a terrible drugs problem and a terrible alcohol problem, and things need to be done about it. But actually, I'm not sure it was quite as bad a result as you think, and I'll go on to talk about the Labour Party in Scotland in a minute, if you like, but a 6,000 majority, I need to know what the turnout was, if it was the same as it was at the general election when it was a 14,000 majority. But if the turnout was lower, which I suspect it was, being a by-election, then you'd expect the majority to be lower. Maybe not as much as that. But I know Scotland quite well, having been born there, and my son is one of the top journalists on the Herald, which is a Scottish newspaper.
But I suppose
what I think is that the Labour in Scotland is having a hard time with the SNP at the moment. And the reason for it is that the Scottish Labour Party is too like the English Labour Party. What the Scottish Labour Party needs to do is to distinguish itself from the British, well, the English Labour Party and the Welsh Labour, and become the Scottish Labour Party truly. At the last general election, well, actually the local elections just recently, the Labour Party in Scotland was trotting out things that were being said from Westminster, and that's not the way to win elections in Scotland now. The SNP has changed the landscape, political landscape, and the Labour Party in Scotland has just begun to realise it.
But what's the Labour Party going to do about jobs? I mean, this is a real serious problem there in Inverclyde. I mean, in a place which was used to building, you know, maybe 7 or 8 shipyards, now there's only one. Something else has to be found for those people. I mean, there's still all the accommodation necessary for that thriving industry, but the industry's gone.
The industry's gone, really, from the British Isles. There's very little shipbuilding. It's now all Korea and China and places like that. Labour is just too expensive in this country, and it's really very hard to get these kind of industrial projects back. The future in a country like ours is in manufacturing, very clever manufacturing, the modern type of things, and that's what we're really good at. People tend to think that manufacturing has stopped in this country. Actually, it's the 5th or 6th largest part of our economy is still manufacturing, but it's not ships and things anymore. It's aircraft wings and bits of aircraft engines, that kind of thing. Very clever, modern stuff. Now, what the government should do, and what Labour has been suggesting, I've heard Martin say it numerous occasions, we're cutting far too harshly, and we need to reflate the economy a little bit at the same time. And the debt or the deficit, depending on which bit you're talking about, would be extended a little bit, but we would get more people into work, and that would help to reflate the economy.
Martin, what were your thoughts about what you heard about those ladies in Inverclyde?
I used to work with people in Clyde Bank, because I was at Glasgow University doing a PhD, and we were trying to fix up joint applications between where I was living in Poland, Lubartów in Poland, and Clyde Bank. It's actually Western Bartonshire Council. So I'm very familiar with the situation there. It's grim. It's nasty. People struggle. The drugs issue, I think that's a separate issue. I've argued in favour of legalisation of drugs on this programme many times. You've got to break the criminal market, because that's all that's there now. Well, you know, you've got places like the Inverclyde, where the main industry in the place is in fact drug dealing, and you've got to recognise that and break the link, so that people and in Portugal they've decriminalised all drugs 10 years ago, and in fact it's led to much reducing people actually take less drugs. It's less loaded, but ultimately we've got to break the illegal market, because all that dirty money goes somewhere. In fact, it rescued the banking system in 2008. That's where all the dirty money went. That's what kept the banks afloat. And that's the reality of the situation, that the drugs industry is so integrated that it keeps the financial services industry going.
I don't disagree with that. It's difficult to know exactly how to start, but obviously legalising drugs is something we should look at. Portugal's the only place in the world where it's really been successful. But yeah, we need to start thinking about it, because the current system isn't working.
Holland a little bit as well.
But Holland keep rowing back every now and again.
Well, they try to, and then they've just rowed forward again this week. Anyway, we're joined by Marina Morris. Why do we believe the unbelievable, Marina?
Hello. Really, why do we believe the unbelievable? What is unbelievable when much of the Muslim world believes that Mossad, the Israeli secret service, were behind the 9/11 attacks, whilst many people in the West believe the attack was masterminded by Osama bin Laden and carried by Al-Qaeda? There are more than 50 different 9/11 conspiracy theories circulating. Our politicians seek to persuade us that Iraq, Afghanistan and now Libya were and are justifiable wars. But if our fundamental beliefs were totally different, it is easy to see how others might view our governments and their action as despotic and us as their puppets. Who controls the news, and why should we believe them? Why do people, companies, or governments want to control what we believe? Why else do companies spend so much time, effort, and money on advertising? In a word, it's power. Control how they must think, and you get to influence the future toward the path you wish to direct it towards. The manipulation of information is one obvious answer. We expect attempts to mislead us. John Kennedy was assassinated as a part of conspiracy, says Dr. Patrick Lemon, a leading figure in study of conspiracy. He said that there are two main reasons why people believe in the unbelievable. First, they see a gap in their understanding and feel it's this ambiguity rather than a trusted account. And the second, belief in conspiracy is highest among those on the peripheries of society. Those not part of the mainstream are more likely to engage in conspiracy as a way of being part of something. There is another door for distrust. In our mind, it is a set of preferences, what we choose to believe and who we trust, that governs how we think and feel. There are big differences in how people in different countries see the world. In the European and World Value Survey, study designed to allow international comparison of value and norms, in each country, random samples of the population were asked whether or not they agree with the statement, most people can be trusted. The countries with similar average income per person had very different level of trust. People trust each other most in Scandinavian countries and the Netherlands. Sweden has the highest level of trust, this 66% of population thinking they can trust others. The lowest level of trust in Portugal, 10% of population trust. In rich market democracies, differences are more than six times. The UK trust score is about 30%. What is distrust and how does it affect you and society? A number of conviction studies in the United States have linked trust to quality of life, health, and greater longevity. Trust leads to cooperation, effectiveness, camaraderie, common goods, patriotism and loyalty. People who trust others are more likely to donate time and money to helping other people. They are supportive, feel secure, believe in common culture, shared values that everybody should be treated with respect and tolerance. Suspicious mind pattern work in the opposite way, imprisoning us in negativity and affecting physical, social and mental health. Psychologists call this way of seeing the world emotional hijacking. It is the inability to manage and control negative feelings, giving power to instinct lead you, losing the inner battle between reasons and feelings. There is no benefit for seeing the world in this way. It is an intellectual puzzle for us, a two-way street. On one side, we risk accepting distorted truth as a fact, and on other, distorting truth into errors by generating false conspiracies within our minds. Next Friday, we will explore another piece of intellectual puzzle. Can only quantity of money bring quality in your life? Does money make you happy? And now, what do people of Bristol think about 9/11 conspiracy theories? Do you believe that Osama bin Laden was behind the 9/11 attacks?
I do, yes. Yeah, I don't believe in any conspiracy theories.
I'm not sure. I think probably yes.
That is tricky. I'm not quite sure. I think it's kind of irrelevant. He's more of just a figurehead for the Islamic East in general.
Yes, I'd go along with that. I'd probably say also that for a long time, West has had to create media characters for people
bogeymen,
absolutely. People to be able to focus the fear so that they can... Western governments can justify...
Invade countries invasion. To secure oil...
That's right.
...bases.
And the reduction in civil liberties at home, that sort of thing. I don't think we get enough information to know whether he was actually involved in the attacks, but...
It's almost irrelevant, really, isn't it, whether he is or not?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of... That's what evidence suggests, I suppose, and stuff that you've heard points towards that direction. Also, I wouldn't probably know myself, but yeah.
Yeah, I'd say the same. We haven't really got defining evidence, but it suggests that.
There's the conspiracy theories and stuff, but I don't tend to believe those because you're going to get those with every significant event and you're going to get those who don't believe it and those who do. But I mean, like, the defining perception and the evidence presented suggests that Osama bin Laden was behind the attacks.
I think it's bigger than that. I think everyone's just blaming one person. I'd say it's probably, like, the government, America... And they've just blamed it on Osama bin Laden to take the dairy off him.
Yeah, I think it's a conspiracy, really. Yeah, I think George Bush had a lot to do with it, because he had a lot of ties in oil, and, yeah, it was all about the oil, really. And that's why they went into Iraq as well.
No, I think he would have claimed it if he was.
Probably a number of people. Well, it would have been the people who benefited from the actions that followed afterwards.
Is it right to question the official story?
Oh, definitely, yes. Because there's so much, with the internet these days, there's so much, I should say, disinformation out there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's right to question things.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely.
Just because we think we're from a democratic Western countries doesn't mean that our governments are particularly honest and truthful all the time.
I think everybody's got a right to question it, because it's such a big event, you know, like a turning event in, like, kind of the modern world, I suppose, then everybody, it's naturally that everyone will question it and will have, you know, difference of opinion and things like that, but I don't think there is enough evidence to be able to question it against what has been shown and stuff.
Yeah, same, I don't think we're ever going to really know the full story.
Of course, always right to challenge what we get told to find the truth.
Yeah, I think it's always okay to question stories. We don't always accept the first thing that is being presented to us.
That was Marina Morris talking to you out on the streets about 9/11 particularly, conspiracy theories generally, but specifically on 9/11, Doug Naismith, former Labour MP, now Labour councillor for Avonmouth. Your thoughts about, you know, how we can actually be trusting our politicians and trusting our media, because there's a kind of two-way thing here. There's a lot of these kinds of conspiracies. People just feel that we're being betrayed by our media and betrayed by our politicians.
Well, you have to accept, first of all, that there's lots of reasons to distrust media people, not all of them, many media people, and many politicians, and that is inherent in our democracy, that You know, you very rarely trust them totally ever. But I tend to approach these things and almost everything else in my life, actually, because I used to be a scientist and I try to construct evidence for and against things. And it's usually very easy to find bits that don't fit in, because life is always untidy. But I tend to try to be swayed by the evidence. And the most recent big thing where that happened with me was when Tony Blair was trying to persuade me to vote for the war in Iraq, and I just told him I refused to support it because I didn't believe that the Iraqis had, it was, you know, the hint was that they had nuclear weapons or biological weapons of a new severity. They didn't have any such thing, nor did they have the ability to deliver them if they had. And it just, the evidence was there, and it convinced me that, you know, what was being said at the time wasn't true. And I used that for everything, including 9/11. I mean, some of the supporters of the 9/11 conspiracy theory, including, I suspect, Martin, they are anti-American to start with, so they want to believe the worst about America that they can in every instance. And I lived in America for 2 years. I was a postdoctoral fellow at Yale University, and I met lots of very intelligent, very interesting, very good people, as well as some of the nutcases.
I think, to be fair to Martin, I don't think he's anti-American. It's the American government and foreign policy that he mostly has a go at. But what about this general thing, Doug, about politicians and journalists kind of wanting to go with the pack and not really being able to speak out, or not feeling that they can speak out in a situation, say, for example, with the Iraq war? Well, how did you feel it was possible? Because most of the MPs went along with it.
Most of them went along with it because they tend to believe the leaders about things they don't know much about. And as I say, I was a scientist, and I knew how difficult it is to get biological weapons and also nuclear weapons as well. And I just didn't believe that Iraq could possibly possess those. And maybe other people believed what the leaders at the time said.
Martin, what about how do we move towards a situation in Sweden where there is much more trust?
Well, you've obviously got more trust in some societies than in others. I mean, America is a country where there's a lot of distrust because there's an awful lot of nasty stuff that the government has done. On the record stuff, let's leave 9/11 aside, the Iran-Contra affair in the 1980s is all on the record. They were bringing millions of dollars worth of cocaine into the country through the MENA air base in Arkansas, dishing it out to the Crips and the Bloods, and funding a terrorist war in Nicaragua that killed 30,000 civilians. Meanwhile, they were ravaging Mozambique, ravaging Angola. These people are frankly barbarian.
Okay, so how do we get a Sweden type situation here? How do we move towards
that? We should have a socialist government like they've had in Sweden since 1936, and we should build nursery schools and look after each other. That's what we should
do. Unfortunately, not at the moment.
No, they've started. They're starting.
One of the great things about Sweden is it's a small country, and people know each other. You know, the politicians meet the population much more. And it used to be like that.
Palmer, of course, was shot. And there's a question that he may have been shot as part of Gladio. Because he wandered around. He wandered around
talking to people in a film.
He wandered around talking to people. He was open. And, of course, he was an easy target. Easy target.
And the same used to be true in Scotland. People knew the local politicians, and probably still do to a certain extent. And
okay, our last story this week, bring back the British. Most Jamaicans say, this is on the weekend of St Paul's Carnival, they would be better off ruled from London. And this is the Daily Mail. Most Jamaicans believe they'd be better off if they were still ruled by Britain. In a harsh indictment of nearly 50 years of independence, 60% of those surveyed hanker for the days when the country was Britain's biggest Caribbean colony. 17% said the crime-riven, poverty-stricken nation would be worse off under British rule. The depth of feeling is particularly astonishing as generations of Jamaica's leaders have portrayed the British as oppressors who subjected the Caribbean to slavery. Well, I don't know if they portrayed them, they were. The Queen is still Jamaica's head of state under the headline, Give Us the Queen. The Gleaner, Jamaica's biggest newspaper, said its poll showed people had become disillusioned with the violent and corrupt political gangs running the island. Just quickly, Martin.
Well, I mean, Jamaica's got a lot of problems like many third world countries. The gang warfare is politicised, so you've got the JLP and the PNP gangs fighting each other. Massive drugs problem, loads of poverty. It's a bit of a mess.
Are you surprised, Doug?
I'm not surprised, because one of the things I think that they have there is a very big problem with drugs.
Okay.
And that's made it very difficult.
Going to have to finish it there. Thanks very much, Doug Naismith, Avonmouth Labour councillor. We'll see you after the news.
It's your choice. BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a